This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. You can join the conversation on our website, wnpr.org/The Wheelhouse. And you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. As always, you can call us to talk about the week's news, 860-275-7266. We're here today, as always, with Colin McEnroe. He is the host of The Colin McEnroe Show here on Connecticut Public Radio. Howdy, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
Also here is Jonathan Wharton. He's Assistant Professor of Political Science and Urban Affairs at Southern Connecticut State University. Hello there, Jonathan.
Good morning, John.
And Christine Stewart, Editor-in-Chief of CTNewsJunkie.com. Welcome back, Christine.
Thanks.
And happy holidays to everyone. There's a lot to talk about. And let's start with Governor Dan Malloy, who presided over his last state bond commission meeting. It's where state borrowing decisions are made. Speaking to the media afterward, he defended himself against critics who say there's been too much borrowing, not enough job growth in Connecticut over the past 8 years. He's handing over the reins to Ned Lamond on January 9th. Here's a little sample of some of the things he told reporters on what could have been his last public pronouncements as governor.
Let's see if I can do this by memory. Governor Weicker saw the loss of 36,000 jobs during the time that he was governor. Governor Rowland netted, by the time he left office, 63,000 net jobs. Governor Rell saw the loss of 33,000 jobs. And while I've been governor, we've seen the creation of 100,000 jobs. Now, if you gave that scorecard to anybody out on the street, particularly after candidates running for governor said we were bleeding jobs, they wouldn't believe it. I wish I'd been able to make allies in the business community understand that their constant bad-mouthing of the state was hurting our desire, their desire, to make the state a stronger attraction to out-of-state employers.
So there's a lot in there, Christine, and probably a lot more that he talked about yesterday. We can, I suppose, start with the jobs thing, where he's trying pretty hard to make sure people understand what happened on his watch. One of the things he made clear was, we would have done even better with jobs, except I cut so many state workers that cut against my numbers as well. So how's he doing at reframing this message of Dan Malloy, unpopular governor who lost jobs here in Connecticut?
He is trying to do his best spinning, I guess, the economic growth that happened during his administration. And I think that it did. And I think so back when he came into office in 2011, he needed to do a bunch of big things. And he did those big things, and the economy didn't act as it had in the past. And so he had to adjust to that, and it was not really an easy adjustment. And I think his criticism of the business community is a little bit unfair because in order to be credible, the business community does have to talk about the challenges that Connecticut has. And the reason that the economic growth didn't necessarily – or the reason our budget situation is what it is because – we failed to fund the pension for 30 years, not because of what Dan Malloy did over the past 8 years.
But I think and maybe we can get back to that bad mouth in Connecticut, something that we've heard an awful lot about and talked a lot about. An awful lot of that bad mouthing, I think, that he's addressing, though, specifically has to do with tax policy. There's an awful lot of business organizations, I can think of a few, that only seem to talk about how high tax rates are here. And if you continue to talk about it, Dan Malloy's point is that eventually people aren't going to want to do business here. It's not going to help us rebound. It's not going to do anything to help future economic growth.
Right. And you know what? Taxes are not necessarily the economy. And also the stock market is not the economy. So I think that people have to be careful when they're talking about those things.
Colin, what did you hear in Dan Malloy's last little speech there?
I think I heard the true Dan Malloy, which is to say that there really are kind of two different facets to him. I basically think history is going to say that Dan Malloy was a pretty good governor. Not a perfect governor, some obvious failings, but on balance, I think his achievements are going to outweigh his liabilities. I don't think he's seen that way right now. History can't possibly be less kind to him than the present has. And so there's a lot. If he sits down and lists everything that he's accomplished in lots of different spheres, there's a lot that he can claim. He's also, but the other thing that you hear in that clip is how bad he is at communicating things about himself. He doesn't say it the right way. He doesn't pick the right place. I should put my cards on the table. I see this as someone who's currently negotiating with his people to get him to do a kind of exit interview with me, a full show exit interview with me. I'd like to do that kind of for those reasons. I think he's a pretty misunderstood politician. But one of the reasons he's a misunderstood politician is he's so terrible. Like, that wasn't even the right way to say the thing about CBIA. Let's say CBIA, because that's like who we're talking about right now. And so CBIA, if you look at their rhetoric over the last 8 years, it's borderline treasonous. I mean, they basically depict Connecticut as a really terrible place to come and do business, which is not their freaking job. Their freaking job is the opposite of that. And it's okay to, yes, it's sure, it's okay to complain about structural problems and things you'd like to see fixed, but not to the exclusion of having a positive message about Connecticut, which they have often failed to do. I don't blame Malloy for saying that, but he said it the wrong way in the wrong place at the wrong time. He's a bad communicator, especially about himself. I think he's a more effective governor, probably a little bit behind the scenes. Although behind the scenes, he doesn't get along with anybody either.
There's some stuff in there I want to get back to, but I want to get your take too, Jonathan, on this. And Dan Malloy, not just the way he's communicating this message, mm-hmm. but also, you know, how we're going to remember this governor after 8 years.
Well, it's interesting he says this now. I think it's too little too late. And going back to Colin's main point in terms of his legacy, to be frank with you, I think people are overlooking that he was a better mayor than he was governor. And I lived in Stamford at the time in the late 90s, and many people did like him. And I think he's more effective that way in the executive leadership than anything else, probably because he got along better with the city government there, as obviously what's going on with still the ongoing saga of the General Assembly. You know, he's a lame duck governor now. His popularity ratings are still at the bottom. We can't forget those aspects of his not only, you know, communication issues, as Colin brought up, but just in general his problems.
But when you're a mayor of a city, you know, mm-hmm. a mid-sized city like Stamford, you have the ability to affect an awful lot more change.
Absolutely.
You have to play well with people when you're working at the state capitol, and you've got Democrats who have very different ideas about being a Democrat than maybe Dan Malloy does. You've got Republicans who have very much a different idea. I mean, okay, so he didn't get along with people necessarily, but the structural problems that we see right now that Ned Lamont is going to have to pick up, you cannot possibly say they're all Dan Malloy's fault.
Well, true. And, of course, he's saying long term, which is a good point. And going back to even Christine's, you know, the thing that you raised earlier, and I'm concerned about this for the future of Lamont. What about the unions? Because the pension obligations, the finances are going to be required, the negotiations, the buyouts, who knows what's going to happen. That's going to be obviously in Lamont's hands. But this is something that obviously Malloy had to carry on for as long as he did throughout his legacy as governor.
Well, what happens with that, Christine? So, I mean, that's an important piece of this whole thing. Ned Lamont now picks up the mantle of a governor who had in some ways some rocky relationships with unions, had some negotiations with them to get some concessions. Many people from the outside would say nowhere near enough concessions to fix any sort of structural damage that has been done previously. What happens with that relationship moving forward?
It's interesting because what does Ned Lamont have to offer the unions to negotiate and to get to the table? There's nothing. There's no carrot. There are only sticks left. And so I don't see that they're going to be able to have much of a relationship.
Colin, I just want to say, Colin, getting back to something you were saying, you know, Christine had said earlier that the economy is not necessarily jobs, is not necessarily, you know, we always conflate all these things. It's not necessarily the stock market. The governorship is not just jobs numbers, and it's not just the state of the budget. It's an awful lot of things, and that's where I think we've spent some time over the course of the last couple of weeks thinking about Dan Malloy's legacy in a slightly different way, because if you add up all the things that aren't just the litany of jobs numbers he talked about, he comes out with a little different scorecard, I think, for an awful lot of people.
Yeah, I mean, I think you could look at things like I go back to this day. We were talking about this yesterday. I was going to be on a panel at UConn Law School, but it was like an audience full of lawyers. But, I mean, not just sort of, you know, I mean, smart lawyers who were interested in going to hear a panel about some obscure subject. And Malloy walked in and got a standing ovation. You know, there are places where Dan Malloy can still walk in and get a standing ovation. And a lot of those places are people who, in places where people might be a little bit more keenly attuned to some of his policies. So certainly shrinking the size of the prison population and the whole kind of second chance initiative. You know, it's one of the reasons he got criticized this last week for flying all over the country. Well, one reason he's flying all over the country is people want to hear what he has to say because he's had some pretty good successes here in the area of criminal justice and correctional reform. reform, you know, and there's a whole bunch of these other things that you can tick off. You know, I mean, I've got my criticisms of this guy, too. I think he relied way too much on corporate welfare as a tool of economic development. So everybody's got their little bone to pick with him. But, you know, I think the balance of his time is better than the 22% or whatever it is approval rating that he seems to have.
Well, how about you, Jonathan? I mean, how do you rate him overall, not just on some of these things that are very hard for a governor to do all on his own, but all these other things that he was able to accomplish?
I think I'm waiting to see what the final result will be. I'm still on the fence about him. You know, it's not that I don't like him. I just don't know if he gets it, that he's got an image problem. I never got a sense to whether anything resonated with him. Did he really understand the implications of Aetna leaving, of GE leaving? I mean, did he understand that and why CBIA is so much against him? I don't get a sense of that, or whether he's really resolute to that. So I'm concerned about that issue. What would I give him? I don't even know where to even begin. Maybe somewhere in a C-plus range, B-minus at best. I'm being generous as a professor.
Yeah, but I mean, to get back to Colin's earlier point, I mean, CBIA has been doing this for an awful long time.
Have.
It doesn't matter if it's Dan Malloy or anybody else. They've got a note on the piano that they're going to play over and over again, matter who the governor is. GE, okay, he lost GE. What happens to GE? They go up to Boston. Their stock price tanks. They're not able to do any of the things that they think they're going to do. And maybe it doesn't seem like losing GE was such a bad deal after all. At a certain point, some of the things that have been accruing to the negative column for him, you look back on and go, I don't know, is this really either this governor's fault or something that we should really hold against him long term as causing a problem for the state?
It's easy to point the finger at the executive. And my professor at Rutgers, Alan Rosenthal, said all the time, it's the governor that gets the attention, not the General Assembly or state legislature. And he's got a point. So he's got to be the one to carry the football on this. I was looking for a governor to stand up and say, this is an issue, this is a problem, we're going to address it. And I'm, you know, going back to Colin's main point, I love economic development. I've been concerned about that. As he raised about the corporate welfare, I don't see it an actual way of what he said, of articulating, this is what we're going to do in response to what happened with GE or these corporations CBIA.
What's interesting, Christine, though, is on a couple of topics, including one that Colin mentioned, prison reform, criminal justice reform, everything having to do with gun control. He actually did say that. I mean, he said, these are problems we're going to fix. He was out in front. And then those are exactly the issues that he's got national attention for. Those are the issues where he will be remembered, at least among some, very, very fondly for his work.
No, I think that's definitely going to be his legacy. And I think that Governor-elect Ned Lamont has some big shoes to fill in that regard, to make sure that the state of Connecticut doesn't backtrack on some of those initiatives. So I think that, you know, Governor Malloy in some of his waning days is trying to make sure and guarantee that those things stay in place.
I mean, I guess the couple points that I would make, too, is some of the things that he's going to be blamed for or faulted for not correcting are things that he actually has kind of corrected. He has shrunk the size of government considerably. I'll infuriate Jonathan and say Democrats tend to be a lot better at shrinking the size of government than Republicans do. Republicans talk.
I'm also a state employee, so
Republicans talk a lot about it. I mean, the biggest size.
They shrank state government, but they did not shrink the higher ed system.
Right, they did not do
that.
That's
a good point.
He did not do that. But yeah.
Speaking of Jonathan, by the way.
Except for the higher ed system.
It was just across the street anyway, yeah. Colin.
Right. Clinton and Gore were the greatest federal government cutters. They cut 625,000 federal jobs. Malloy has cut in the five figures, I think, of state government jobs. It's a smaller government than he took over. The people who are new hires are on a much more stringent kind of union contract. I mean, the so-called union contract problems exist among people who've been there a long time and are basically governed by contracts that existed way before Malloy. The two sets of concessions that Malloy got will mostly affect the people, more recently hired and being hired in the future. But those people will not have this kind of offensive to some luxurious benefits that you hear a lot about. So, I mean, I think even in those areas, you have to give him a little bit of credit.
Okay, can you give him some credit in those areas, Jonathan?
I can. I especially since I got brought on under his administration anyway, to go back to your point with his contracts. And God knows, I still can't figure out my hybrid pension thing, but whatever. That's another story. And so I get it. You know, he attempted to do the almost impossible, but I was just looking for more bold leadership, more bold ideas, I guess, even in terms of dealing with the unions and everything else. I just didn't see it stand out.
We're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about leadership some more. But this time we're going to talk about party leadership. Will the Democrats have a new party leader? Will the Republicans have a new party leader? We're talking with a Republican right now, Jonathan Wharton. He's assistant professor of political science and urban affairs at Southern Connecticut State University. Also with Christine Stewart, editor-in-chief of CTNewsJunkie.com, and our own Colin McEnroe, host of The Colin McEnroe Show. This is The Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. Join our conversation on our website, WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can always find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. And today you can find us on CTN, the Connecticut Network. They're here with their cameras. And I want to make sure you know who's on the program today. Jonathan Wharton, he's assistant professor of political science and urban affairs at Southern Connecticut State University. You can follow him on Twitter at PreppyProf. I always tell people it's a very good follow.
Thank you.
Christine Stork, you can find at CT News Junkie. She's editor-in-chief of CTNewsJunkie.com is here as well. And Colin McEnroe, host of The Colin McEnroe Show. He tweets at Colin McEnroe. And he's also got a show this afternoon. Colin, what's your show today?
Well, every so often, the singer-songwriter Jill Sobule just descends upon my studio and does whatever she wants to do for about an hour. She's really funny. She's incredibly creative and spontaneous. She's performing in the library of the Twain House for three nights starting last night. So we have her here in town. We're going to do it again. One thing we're going to do this time that we haven't done before, because we are in the middle of a pledge drive, is rather than throw to the pledge breaks, Jill and I are going to stay here, and Jill's going to make up reasons or perhaps even songs. I mean, she doesn't know any of this. I haven't told her this yet. But she'll be doing our pledge breaks today.
So pledge drive songs.
Yes, pledge drive songs and
created live, just on the the moment.
Yeah, that's spontaneous exhortations of a musical and non-musical kind.
That is excellent. So that's coming up on the Colin McEnroe Show today at 1 o'clock. So you'd think that after re-winning us every statewide office and every Connecticut congressional seat, and greatly expanding the ranks in the General Assembly, well, Democrats would be happy with their state party chair. But instead, there's some uncertainty over whether the chairman, Nick Belletto, will get to keep his job. Governor-elect Ned Lamont has remained silent on whether he supports Belletto staying on for another term. Well, I'll go to you first, Christine. So what do we know about this? Who's going to be leading the state Democratic Party?
I don't think we know. So Nick Belletto would like to. He's making the calls to state central committee members. And, you know, I think that he has a good case to make. Obviously, Democrats did very well in the past election. But at the same time, he was also the same person who tried to talk Ned Lamont out of running for governor.
So that probably is the sort of thing that the incoming governor might remember?
Yeah, I think it's something that he remembers. And I think that, you know, he could possibly. So there's nobody necessarily, you know, kind of like a Nancy Pelosi situation. There's nobody necessarily running against Belletto right now. So there's no challenger to his crown. But we also have, you know, the incoming governor who, you know, really should be making a decision about who he wants to run his political operation.
Who should be potentially making a decision? Jonathan, you understand this world much better than I do. I mean, what does a party chair do, and how much credit should a Nick Belletto get for big wins for the Democrats?
I think he should get a big win for this because it's something that's his legacy that he's going to be well known for. And he's an old school. I've kind of known him actually in the last couple of years. I think you all know he was a former alderman and president, so I've gotten to know him over the years. He's a very much kind of an old school retail kind of a backslap. What do you say, Christine? Kind
yeah.
of a, you know, operative. And so that's very different than somebody like a Ned Lamont. So I could already see in terms of stylistic issues their differences. And so I'm curious to see how this is going to be played out. You can't take him for granted because he's got the New Haven base. And in New Haven, they like him a lot. And Vinnie Morrow, who is the New Haven chairman as well, they get along very well. You can't ignore that region in the state. They are Democrats. And they did show up to give credit in New Haven. They did. And they might have been the last city out for the numbers with the governor's race. But they did show up.
They stood in very long lines.
They
turned out. Nobody, you know, they weren't able to actually have an election there
yep.
that worked right, but they did
Election
turn
out. Day registration, exactly. I mean, they used it all right to the point where it's obviously it's still in court.
But. So, Colin, what do you think of this?
I always wonder why anybody wants this job, because if your party doesn't do well, you're a bum. And there's no question about that. Like,
right.
J.R. Romano is a bum right now because his party lost the election.
I think he's probably going to be more like a phoenix, though,
right.
out of this.
But you don't get that much credit, nor do you really deserve that much credit for big victories. Like, Alex Bergstein didn't win in Greenwich because because of Nick Bolletto. She went out and organized her own campaign and did a really good job. State chairs tend to do more like putting out fires. Like, let's say there's this highly dysfunctional race in Waterbury, they might sort of try to steer some help over there or get an operative over there who actually knows what they're doing, that kind of stuff. But it's not that big a job. And basically, the only people you have to impress are the state central committee because they elect you. The governor does not pick the state chairman and probably won't have that much influence. Lamont is a relatively new figure on the political screen. I'd be more interested in knowing what George Jepson or Denise Merrill or Kevin Lembo or somebody like that thinks about Nick Bolletto. I don't happen to know the answer to those questions, but it would probably be more relevant. I will say Ed Marcus was the Democratic chairman for I don't know how long. Lots of people didn't like Ed Marcus. Lots of insurrections by pretty competent and powerfully backed rebels were launched against Ed Marcus, and they never took him out because he had the state central committee, which is, I mean, and they're like, the army of the dead in the third Lord of the Rings movie. That's basically what the state central committee looks like.
Well, so. I'm glad to know that that's what I am, since I'm on state central for the Republican Party.
You're the youth movement.
Christine, you wanted to jump in?
Yeah, no, I think it's interesting because I think that George Jepson has been advising Lamont very closely. And so I think that, George Jepson may know who the next party chair is.
Right.
Mm. So, I mean, to Colin's point, should it matter if the governor gets along with the state party chair?
Governor Malloy thinks it should matter. So Governor Malloy thinks that, since the party operation is much closer to the governor and to the state level than it is to Washington and the senators there, that it should be the governor's choice.
But we should say one of the big blots on the Malloy escutcheon is a scandal that ran through state central.
That is true.
Because there was too much coordination between. It wasn't a good thing that Malloy and state central and the state chairman got along in that situation. Sometimes it's good to maybe have a little distance. Let the political weasels do their weasel stuff and you be governor.
The other thing we have to remember is that the party chairs back in the day had a lot more power compared to what they have now. So there is a distinction in terms of party, bosses back in the 50s and 60s in Connecticut and most states. But now they're pretty much watered down because of state
central. Possibly why John Bailey's grandson is the one person being mentioned as a possible Bolletto
successor.
Right. Bring back some of the old school style.
What about other jobs in this Lamont administration coming up, Christine? We talked about a few last week, and there were a couple more announcements made this week. Who's kind of lining up to get these jobs? What can you read from the hires that Ned Lamont has made so far?
No, I think that he's made some interesting hires. I think that it didn't strike me until I started writing the story, but I think Melissa McCaw, who's going to be his secretary of the Office of Policy and Management, is interesting in that she will also now be the co-chair of the Municipal Accountability Review Board, or the MARB, and that MARB has control over the city of Hartford. And who is her co-chair? The co-chair will be Sean Wooden as state treasurer. So I feel like, within Hartford has maintained or possibly gained some power within this Lamont administration.
Colin, any thoughts?
I was interested in Colleen Flanagan Johnson being picked. Colleen Flanagan Johnson is well known to the press, was a campaign publicist for a while and then transitioned over into various parts of the government. She knows state government pretty well, can be rather sharp-tongued when, in a funny way, when necessary, so which is not a tone one associates with Lamont. But typically what you want to do is build up people around you who compensate for whatever deficit you have or are a little bit different from the way that you rely on too much. So Flanagan Johnson, I guess, might be an interesting choice that way.
Well, and I think that she's interesting because she also has the experience of transitioning from communications director on Malloy's campaign to the communications office for Malloy when he took office in 2011.
We just have a couple more minutes before the break. Let's turn to the Republicans, Jonathan. And we've talked about this before.
Yes.
Haven't really sat down and talked with you.
Right.
If indeed we're talking about Nick Bolletto today, after a whole series of big Democratic wins, maybe being out of a job because, I don't know, he doesn't get along with Ned Lamont potentially. How about our friend J.R. Romano, who runs the Republican Party? They didn't win very much.
No.
And J.R. Romano, is anybody talking about taking him out?
There's been talk of it. I don't think he's ruled out running out another term. I mean, he hasn't said one way or the other whether he would or wouldn't. But there has been talk. I've heard several candidates. Don't be surprised if you might hear some people who've run for office, for statewide office, who want to run. I'm hearing names of two or three people at least, and I'm hearing two or three other names as well. So it might be a half dozen names that might be
offered.
Are you
able to give us any of those names, Mr. Insider?
Nothing official.
I have to ask you.
It's not until June,
right,
so there's plenty of time.
That's a good point. And you know one thing? I had to go back to my old emails just figure out back in 2015 what took place. And the timeline, to be fair, we won't know who the candidates really will be until they start going out and going to the RTCs, lobbying state central members until about February, March.
Is there something structurally or philosophically, culturally different with the way that Republicans do this and the way that Democrats do this in terms of how they might choose someone for a job like this?
Absolutely. It's very similar to what happens with the governor's race. We get as many people out there to run. And so it's kind of a divide and conquer and see what happens when we come back together again. So it's more that dynamic.
Pick the guy who spends the most money on television.
Well, okay, there's that aspect to it at least. But it's also that, you know, it's a reality of, you know, who can be a fresh face? Who can be new? Who can do things differently? And I think there's going to be some resolve to deal with that in terms of what happened with this election and future elections, quite frankly.
Colin?
You know, there's probably, I think, three major reasons why they lost a lot of races last time. Trump, which they can't control. I mean, they can distance themselves from Trump, which they didn't do, but they can't really control the Trump problem totally. I still think guns is a really big issue. I think it hurt them in the campaign. But the other reason they lost is because they kind of got outworked. Now, there aren't as many Republicans, but they're 22%. But they're pretty loyal, you know, and their ground games got just blown off the map by a lot of Democratic candidates. And that you can maybe put on the chairman. You can maybe say, why did we get out hustled, you know, in Tony Boucher's district or Scott Francis' district or any of these districts where we won? Why did Christine Cohen out hustle Adam Greenberg? And maybe that's something that you do put on the chairman a little bit.
We have a little less than a minute left, Christine, but Joe Markley, who ran with Bob Stefanowski, said Bob Stefanowski lost because, you know, he over-relied on campaign staff from outside Connecticut, amongst other reasons. That was an interesting little back and forth this week.
Yeah, no, I think that there was a heavy emphasis on consultants with the Stefanowski campaign, and actually getting to Bob Stefanowski was not easy for reporters and others. So I think that did have an impact on this campaign.
Let me add something else, John. I think you're going to see some internal, you know, decision-making about who's going to be on State Central next time around, because those elections are going to be taking place too soon. So don't be surprised you hear some names being thrown out there for that.
Jonathan Wharton is Assistant Professor of Political Science at Southern Connecticut State University. Christine Storz here from CTNewsJunkie.com. Colin McEnroe is here. And now we're going to throw it over to some colleagues who are going to tell you why and how you can support Connecticut Public Radio. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. We're also on CTN, the Connecticut Network Today, joined by Jonathan Wharton, Assistant Professor of Political Science and Urban Affairs at Southern Connecticut State University. Christine Storz here. She's Editor-in-Chief of CTNewsJunkie.com, and we're also joined by Colin McEnroe. We've been talking about Governor Dan Malloy leaving office, saying some final words to the press. Also, U.S. Representative Elizabeth Estey's time in office is coming to an end. She decided against seeking re-election after controversy over her handling of a congressional staff member's abuse and harassment claims against Estey's former chief of staff. Tuesday was Estey's last speech in the House floor. Here's a few of her remarks.
Democracy is about doing your best every day and bringing out the best in others. And when we fail, which we will, we should not give up. We should get right back to work. And you shouldn't run because you know you'll win. You should run because there are things worth fighting for. If we remember our common values, rather than call into question each other's integrity, there's much we can do together. Democracy is something we do. It is not something we tweet about.
So Colin, how will we remember Elizabeth Estey? We talked about Dan Malloy. How do we think about her going out of office?
I think the answer is not much. I mean, we probably won't remember very much, which is maybe unfair. She obviously served in Congress for multiple terms. On the other hand, I think her political future is probably at an end, as she suggests there. I can't really imagine her I mean, people resurrect all the time, and who knows? Maybe she could be running for governor in 8 years. I guess I wouldn't be surprised by anything anymore. I think, you know, if she's smart, she'll pick an issue that works for her. I think gun violence, gun control, gun storage, gun safety, given the district that she's from and given the fact that she is prominently associated with that already, pick that and be kind of an elder statesman. I guess she wouldn't like that term, about that issue. And that's about what you can hope for, I think. And occasionally, I mean, think of the other former members of Congress who are hanging around these days. So every once in a while, Chris Chase pops up with some urgent message for all of us, or Nancy Johnson goes on Face the State to talk about George H.W. Bush. There's not that much to do if you're a former member.
I saw Sam Gaidenson a couple of years ago because he had a new radio show on Paul Bass's little station, WNHH. Mm. And I thought that was cool.
Right. Or you can become a lobbyist. I mean, some of them do. That's another option.
I'd rather have a show on WNHH,
right.
To be real honest with you.
So depending on how much she likes money and stuff like that, that's another option. But I don't think that she has the kind of profile where we're going to be talking about Elizabeth Esty, and her ideas 2 to 4 years from now.
Yeah, how much of a well-known was she really, even within her district itself, and the big question. It's a key district because I think many people forget it's a swing district technically. I mean, Gary Franks was the former representative, a black Republican back in the day. And Nancy Johnson's district, it's not too far from there. In fact, pieces of it are part of the district now. Mm-hmm. So she doesn't stand out among, let's say, those three. So I don't think people will quite remember her to the degree that maybe her predecessors have.
Any thoughts, Christine?
No, I think that, gun control issues or something involving veterans is something that she could continue to be involved in. I would have liked to see more of a discussion with her departure over non-disclosure agreements and the use of non-disclosure agreements and how Congress deals with that. And I think that there's been a lack of that, and she could have really been a leader in that.
Wow.
I will say that something has come up more recently, Colin, that maybe casts some of this in a different light. I'm reading from Anna Radelat in the Connecticut Mirror. Esty's truncated congressional career may be a cautionary tale to other politicians or not. Senator Kamala Harris from California accepted the resignation of one of her top aides Wednesday after it was revealed the California Department of Justice paid $400,000 to settle sexual harassment complaints against him. Harris's office says the senator did not know about the lawsuit or the harassment claims until recently.
I think this is pretty bad. I mean, we should say, I think it's clear this goes back to her time as AG. This is not one of her U.S. Senate employees. That's why the California Department of Justice would be doing a payout on it. It's not as, so far, not as bad as Esty's story. Esty's story, whenever you reconstruct this timeline of all the things that happened in Esty's story, you're reminded, one of the things with political scandals is, oddly enough, they become less toxic and more inert as time goes by. People think that John Roland just took some hot tubs and kitchen cabinets. They've forgotten the rest. Same with Eddie Perez. With this one, I think people will sort of just think that Elizabeth Esty kind of mismanaged a personnel situation and not remember how bad exactly it was. Now, Harris's could turn out to be every bit as bad. This is one of those things that's a little bit like Iran-Contra. It's bad if you didn't know it was happening, and it's bad if you did know it was happening. It's just bad in two different ways. And she's in the middle of what amounts to an elimination dance, right? If you're trying to run for president, unless it's the 2016 Republican campaign, people are just looking for an excuse to get rid of you. I mean, in the 2016 Republican campaign, they eliminated all the high-functioning, not scandal-tainted people and then ran Trump. But for the most part, these are elimination dances. You give people an excuse to turn their backs on you, and go support Amy Klobuchar or something. You're not helping your cause.
Well, add another wrinkle to this. As a former Hill staffer, because I was up there for a half dozen years, the Capitol Hill is a very different place. Congressional offices all run things differently, separately, independently, and do they really follow the rules? Yay, nay, whatever. I mean, you can't forget some of these personalities up there have big egos, so they don't always follow the rules of law when it comes to, like a sex scandal like this. And I'm thinking about harassment at least. I'm thinking of something like Charlie Wilson's a classic case example, right, back in the day. There's a misogynist who was really out there and was gloating about it. So you're going to get people like this who don't always follow everything down to the T, unfortunately.
But
even
their
staffers, by the way, especially their staffers.
But maybe to Christine's earlier point, though, would it be interesting if in this time, like the Me Too movement mm-hmm. has taken a whole bunch of things and upended them and changed them for the better in American society? Right. We're examining more things. I don't know that we're necessarily examining the way, say, the House of Representatives mm-hmm. polices itself, looks at these questions, how they actually deal with an internal issue like this. I mean, shouldn't that be an outcome of this?
You would think, right? You think they follow the laws. I mean, think about it. John Boehner, among other people, would be able to smoke in his office. I mean, you could do this often on Capitol Hill. There are a lot of things that you would think should be the rule of law. They don't follow the laws. They might write the laws. They don't always follow them. And they don't always have their own laws.
And should taxpayers be on the hook for this?
Very good point.
I mean, should taxpayers be paying money to settle sexual harassment claims?
No.
Exactly. and that's the problem right now, and that's the problem that has not been resolved.
That has not been resolved, and maybe could be resolved with a better investigation of this. I want to move on to something else that happened this week, Colin. I'll read here from our friend Neil Vigder in the Hartford Courant. No love lost between Lowell Weicker and Joe Lieberman, but there's something that's brought these rivals together 20 years after their 1988 Senate race. Donald Trump, they're part of a bipartisan group of 44 former U.S. senators who penned an op-ed piece this week in the Washington Post urging the Senate not to abdicate its historic checks and balances as the nation braces for the release of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation report on Trump. First of all, so it's Dodd, Weicker, Lieberman, a whole bunch of other senators, ex-senators getting together to pen this letter. I thought Joe Lieberman was like looking for a job in the Trump administration.
Well, I always feel that whenever Joe Littlefinger, I mean Lieberman, climbs off your bus, that means your bus is on fire, right? So this is a guy who really pretty carefully examines both sides of the road and then decides which side he's going to stand on. And he's been doing that his entire career, too. He lets the clock tick down pretty low, and then he makes a choice. So it's never a good sign when he walks out on you. So, yeah, it did appear, at least he was allowing his name to be a trial balloon for a couple of different jobs. I think even UN ambassador, which he didn't get, was one of them. I think he probably sees the handwriting on the wall pretty clearly. But this is a pretty significant letter. It probably won't wind up meaning anything because nothing means anything anymore. We live in this kind of nihilistic vacuum where you just can't really.
Why are we even doing this right now? I mean, just be honest.
Exactly.
Wow. God, Colin, you've been scarred.
Well, no. I mean, what do you make of this letter, Jonathan?
I think it's symbolic politics at its best. Yes, I'll go with your analysis of Uncle Joe. You know, he does his own thing. We can never figure it out. We don't have a roadmap. He probably doesn't have one either in terms of a blueprint or what he's thinking, what he could do next.
Oh, he's got a
roadmap. I don't know if I want to pick it up. But the thing is that he's been this way for years, so it's nothing new. But I think this is more symbolic politics. Yes, it is a concern. It certainly speaks more to the U.S. Senate in terms of reminding everybody we should have some power and have some checks and balances. Now, of course, I'm biased because, you know, I love Capitol Hill. I'm all about Congress. Forget the presidency. But I think that, you know... So what happens when you're dealing with a Hill staff or flunky. And for the Senate, please. I worked in the House of Representatives. Don't even get me started about the Hofty Senate. They think they can get away with writing something like this. That's beautiful. But it is gaining a lot of attention. And it's got a lot of tweets out there. If you've seen it, especially with the Washington Post. What does it mean for Trump? Nothing.
All right. Well, let's turn as our final thoughts to something we've been doing for the last couple of weeks, and we really like this. We're asking our panelists to give us feats of strength or maybe a chance to air some grievances. You can do a little bit of both. We're honoring Festivus around this time of the year. So I'll start with you, Christine. So do you have a feat of strength for us, maybe an airing of a grievance?
I do have an airing of a grievance.
Oh, my goodness. Here we go.
Is it not December? It's December, right?
It's December.
Festivus, yeah.
Yes. I cannot find any Christmas stamps to save my life.
Really?
So if you have not received my holiday card, it is because I have been unable to find stamps. I have been to 5 different locations in search of said Christmas stamps, and I do not believe they exist.
Go to New Haven. They've been forcing it on us left and right. I'm sick of Christmas tree stamps.
So, I mean, they make Christmas stamps.
I was like, do they
still
not plan for this time of year where they're going to be sending more letters?
So you're arriving at the Postal Service locations where they just haven't. It's like going to Hartford to try to vote. There's just not enough ballots or something,
exactly.
Right? It's like going to Bridgeport or New Haven. You can't actually do the thing.
Right.
That's what the problem is.
So if my holiday card arrives, you know, metered mail, this is why.
That's what it is. So you're airing a grievance today. I completely understand that one. Jonathan, how about you?
I'm still fed up with I-91. I mean, just to get to Hartford should not take me over an hour from New Haven. There are 3 car accidents on the way here. 3. Can we not be better drivers when there's no snow and there's no rain out there?
Well,
it's just amazing how bad we are.
It's called distracted driving.
My God, I've never seen cars so smashed up on the way here.
I have seen an awful lot of distracted driving on my drive in Route 44. I will say, this will give you a chance, though, to give Governor Malloy a feat of strength, though. I mean, he did a lot of things that Republicans didn't like, Jonathan, but you seem to think that the Hartford line getting built wasn't such a bad gig.
It wasn't. As a matter of fact, I've been waiting for that since I was a kid, back when I was at Kingswood, Oxford. Colin and I's Mac, you know, our alma mater. So I'm grateful to see that line. And actually, I've taken the trains, you know, a couple times to see you all. Big difference taking the train. But boy, we can't drive. We got issues. And you heard about the Merritt Parkway. They closed both ways this morning as well. It's like, can we learn how to, you know, drive and deal with traffic here?
Well, it's actually congestion because I contacted the DOT on this.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, I got a little
homework
into the numbers here.
I love her.
The vehicle miles traveled are the same as they were the previous year.
Huh.
So the same amount of traffic is on the road. We're just way worse drivers.
Okay, so everyone's grieving, Colin. How about you?
I'll do a quick feat of strength. The Oscars, as usual, are in crisis because of Kevin Hart. Who knew? Who knew Kevin Hart said jokes about gay people? Should have been a pretty easy thing to find out. Anyway, this blog called Muppet Mindset is suggesting that the Muppets host the Oscars. I think this is the best idea. I think it would be terrific. I think their ratings would go up. The Oscars would be fun all night long.
You got Oscar the Grouch showing up.
Yeah, you got Oscar the Grouch. Yeah, you already got a guy named Oscar. You know, and certainly you got Statler and Hilton or whatever their names are. I mean, the whole thing could be really, really fun. I want to do two quick airings of grievance.
Please.
I'll do them fast. One of them is, on this show, we warned Bill and Hillary Clinton, don't go on this tour. Nobody wants to see you on this tour. They now have a Groupon deal where across the country at a lot of their gigs, prices are being slashed by more than 50%. They had to go to Groupon for help. And the other thing, very quickly, Pelosi and Schumer yesterday sitting in the White House talking to Trump, and he starts with his crazy talk about he's going to shut down the government if he doesn't get the wall. They should treat all of these situations as Joseph P. Welch situations. You look at him and you say, you are crazy and irresponsible. We're leaving. Don't debate him.
When Pelosi brings up the skunk comment as well. I mean, that's just like, what?
Yeah, don't do anything. just say, that's crazy talk. We'll come back when you can act like a grown-up, but we're out of here right now.
It was unusual to watch that interplay yesterday because from what we understand, the Democrats did not know that this was going to be kind of live press conference with cameras rolling on everything. Trump orchestrated that.
And Mike Pence in the background looking and staring like, wow, what do I do? And you heard about that Curb Your Enthusiasm. They had the music in the background for a couple of things on Twitter. It's awesome.
Go back on Twitter, you'll see it.
Sort of staring into space. I'm going to end with a feat of strength. I was asked yesterday to speak to the annual meeting of a group called Community Partners in Action. They've been around for 140-something years. It's an amazing run for a nonprofit. What they do is they work on criminal justice reform, and they've been working very closely with the Malloy administration. They're trying to keep people out of prison. They're trying to give better opportunities for people when they get out of prison. They've been doing this for a very long time. And, you know, aside from the politics, in which there's very clear politics at work, and they want to be part of whatever solution the next governor has for this issue, one by one, people came up and gave incredibly inspiring stories of how their lives have been changed or how they've been changing other people's lives because of the work. And so I just want to salute them and say it's a pretty good feat of strength to be around for 140-something years, to be, you know, working in such a difficult field, going into prisons and working with a very difficult and disenfranchised population. So good on them. I want to thank our panelists, Jonathan Warden and Christine Stewart and Colin McEnroe, and thank everyone who produces this show. Now I'm going to turn it over to some people who are going to tell you how to give money to support more stuff like this on Connecticut Public Radio.